I'm so glad to be with you all. When I was putting this presentation together, I had not even thought about the fact, this is just the title that I sort of picked, and then I realized that we're doing the story of the Good Samaritan, and the question is, who is my neighbor? Fits perfectly. So a bit of kismet for us there. So today, we're going to talk about kind of an introduction to this subject, and we're going to go over a couple things throughout the week. So today we are going to be talking about trans identities, identity in general, gender in general, and a little bit of history to kind of get us all on the same page. I really don't want to assume that you're coming into this room with any knowledge. So I'm assuming zero knowledge, which means if you are somebody who is coming in with zero knowledge, you're in a good place. If you're coming in and you already know some stuff, you might hear some repeats, but that's okay. We sometimes need that repeat so that we can keep that information in our brains. So today, that's what we're doing today, and then Wednesday and Thursday are both our Bible-heavy days. So Wednesday, being tomorrow, is going to be our session on the trans clobber passages, the passages that are used against trans folks, and ways that we might understand them differently. And then Thursday is going to be our affirming passages, passages that are either in general sort of affirming of the trans community today, or passages that trans people today find connections with, even if it's not necessarily about gender. So we're going to talk about that on Thursday, and then Friday we're going to end with our big day on trans allyship and things we can do to support our trans siblings. So that's our sort of schedule for the week. To tell you a little bit about me and my background before we get started and my sort of introduction to this topic, I'm trans myself, and so that's how I got into it. This is kind of one of those things that you end up as a person with a specific kind of identity that other people may not know much about. You end up sometimes just being the default educator. But then you have to move beyond sort of your own personal history into, like, if you're going to do education work, into, you know, how does my single story connect with other stories? What are our commonalities in our community? So I've been doing this work with churches and with schools since I graduated from seminary in 2014. I went to Luther Seminary. My degree is in Old Testament or Hebrew Bible studies. So that is a little bit of my background. So when we ask this question, who is my transgender neighbor? I really find it helpful to take a big picture, kind of zoom out, a big picture look at the LGBTQ plus community so that we can kind of understand what part of our community we're talking about specifically. Before I get in, though, to specific identity questions, identity definitions, I do want to say that the information that I'm going to be giving you is general information. But if you come across a person in your community who says, oh no, I don't actually identify this way, or I don't actually use these words, default to the person in front of you, right? If the person in front of you says, actually, I don't use this word, I like this word better, default to that. Don't take my word as gospel if the actual person with lived experiences in front of you says something different. So, having said all that, let's zoom out a little bit here. Throughout the week, we're going to be talking about people within the LGBTQI2A+ community. And I know that's a lot of letters, so I want to talk a little bit about these and kind of orient ourselves. So this is what all of these letters stand for: lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer, intersex, two-spirit, asexual, and then the plus for and more. We are adding more sort of identities to this list, more letters to this list, as we go, and that's not a bad thing. I know it sounds overwhelming sometimes. People are like, hey, when are we going to stop adding to this long acronym? But the reality is, the more we know about people, the more we know about the experiences of our neighbors, the more we can kind of like find ways to connect. And the thing that all of these identities have in common is that they are identities that have to do with differences in orientation and gender. So we're going to talk a little bit about what those two things are, but that's what they all have in common. That's why we keep adding to it, is because we keep understanding more about people. So one of the sort of metaphors I like to use when we think about this is the metaphor that, like, before we had telescopes, we would look out into the night sky and we would see, okay, the moon, the stars, maybe we would know some things up there that aren't twinkling, our planets, right? That's kind of all we got. Maybe we've got like the occasional meteor. And then, so that's kind of what we thought we had in the world, in the universe. And then we get telescopes, and suddenly we realize there are black holes and supernovas and quasars and like all kinds of things, right, that we didn't see with our naked eye. I feel like this, the LGBTQ plus community is kind of like that. The more we learn about each other and about ourselves, it's kind of like we've gotten telescopic over time, where we've been able to see things that maybe we didn't see as well before. So it's not that these identities didn't exist prior to the modern world, it's that we are learning more about each other now. So, to think about these identities here, like I said, one of the ways that we can understand how they all fit together is by understanding the difference between orientation and gender. So we're going to talk about those two things. So when we think about orientation, we've got our little stick figure here, the heart being the identifier for orientation there. Your orientation is sometimes known as your sexuality or your sexual orientation or your affectional orientation. That's another word people like to use. It describes the gender of the people you tend to be attracted to. So this is an internal thing. Nobody else can see it. This is not something you can like look at somebody and say, ah, I can tell that you're gay. What you might look at and sort of think that about somebody is you're relying on stereotypes about what you think that might look like. But there's no way to know just by looking at somebody, right? So orientation is an internal thing for you. Orientations in the LGBTQ plus community include folks who are gay, who are lesbian, who are bisexual, meaning they're attracted to people of more than one gender. It doesn't necessarily mean you have relationships with multiple people at the same time. It's just that you can be attracted to a lot of different kinds of people. People who are pansexual, which is similar to bisexual, and there's kind of an interesting intra-community dynamic going on there in that community. People who are asexual, so people who don't experience sexual attraction or who experience it only in certain ways, in certain contexts. So this is all about your attraction to other people. That's what we're talking about when we're talking about orientation.
I didn't understand. Pansexual? I didn't understand that.
Yeah,
so bisexual, bi, of course, meaning two, right? So you, historically, bisexual communities have identified, like described that or given a definition in a couple different ways. The way that makes sense to me and that I like to say as a bisexual person myself is that you're attracted to people who share your same gender identity and people who don't. So that's the two. Rather than saying I'm attracted to men and women, which is also two, but that gets a little bit more into the gender binary that we're going to talk about along the way. So bi meaning two. Pan, of course, is the prefix for all. It's just a Greek prefix meaning all. So being attracted to people of all different kinds of genders.
I didn't know that.
Yep. So that's the difference in the wording. If you're like, wait a minute, description-wise, that sounds like the same thing. You are not alone. There's a lot of community dialogue between folks who identify very strongly as bisexual and people who define very strongly as pansexual. For some people, they really care which one you use. For other people, it's a synonym. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Cool. Right. So, once you stick another person next to this first stick person, you start to make some assumptions about their relationship, right? And you're making that assumption, whether you know it or not, based on gender, but that's coming up next. We make our orientation visible in the world through specific kinds of affectional behavior. That can include things like holding hands, or it can be big social traditions like marriage. That's the way that we usually make what is invisible visible, right? Our orientation is invisible to other people, but as soon as we start doing things, our behavior, it becomes more visible to the rest of the world. Yeah? So this is orientation, right? And we want to kind of hold this in our mind, keep this in your little bubble in your mind, because now we're going to talk about something that is separate, but they often get confused for each other, and that is gender. So there are lots of different ways to describe gender. As you might expect, people have been studying gender for a really long time. There are lots of different models to explain how gender works. This is a model that I'm going to introduce you to that comes from Gender Spectrum, which is a nonprofit organization in San Francisco. And they do a really good job teaching this, and so I asked them if I could use their model. So the way we talk about gender is that there are three interconnected facets. They all affect each other. The three facets are identity, expression, and our body. So we're going to talk about those three factors. So the body section, that has to do with our internal and external reproductive organs, our chromosomes, our hormone levels, and our brain matter. all these things that are part of our body, right? These are all the gendered sort of pieces of that. Now, when we usually talk about this section of the three pieces of gender, a lot of times what people are most talking about is external reproductive organs. That's what they're concerned with, that's what they're talking about. But there's a lot more here to what's going on in your body besides just like the one tiny thing that we are might be concerned with. The second section is your gender identity. So that's your internal self-perception and experience of being female, male, both, or neither. So it's basically, the way we used to say it is, this body section is about what's between your legs, and your identity section is what's in your between your ears. That's how we used to explain this. So we kind of have stopped saying that. It was an easy way to explain, but we kind of stopped saying it because then you don't get all the rest of the body parts that aren't just between your ears, right? Or between your legs, like your chromosomes and your hormone levels. So those two sections we've got, right? Our identity and our body. The third one there is our gender expression. That's the way you show your gender to others through your clothing, hair, mannerisms, voice, etc., which have gendered values in your society. So it's going to be different in different places in the world, right? In some places, if you wear a thing that wraps around your legs but just goes around once, in some places that is a skirt and it's for women, and in other places it's a kilt and it's for men. So it's going to be different in different places in the world. So much like with the orientation bubble that we talked about, how you have like the internal invisible orientation that was made visible through behavior, with our gender, we have our internal gender identity, how we understand ourselves, that is made visible in our gender expression. Does that make sense? Cool. So these three factors, as you might notice, they are interconnected and they interact with each other. It's not as simple as saying, here's three different chunks. Because if your gender identity is happening in your brain's part of your body and it's affected by your hormones, for instance, right? So these are all interconnected, interwoven pieces of how you work. One last thing that I want to say about this three-piece situation here is that we sometimes refer to this body section as somebody's assigned sex. So when we're talking about somebody's assigned sex, basically what we mean is every time somebody is born, the doctors look at one part of your body, your external reproductive organs, and they say, it's a boy or it's a girl. That's your assigned sex. But doctors, unless there's something that's not what the doctors expect, they are very likely to check your chromosomes or your hormone levels or anything else, or your internal reproductive organs. If it's a healthy baby and it looks like a healthy baby, they just go, it's a boy or it's a girl. Not everybody is actually just a boy or just a girl, even in terms of assigned sex. About 1.7% of our population is intersex, which I mentioned in our big acronym. To be intersex means that you have differences in sex development. So there are lots of different ways to be intersex. Some people, if you are familiar, we'll talk about this, I believe we'll mention it later. If you're familiar with the old word hermaphrodite, that's intersex, that's what that is. We don't use the word hermaphrodite anymore because it's an outdated word that doesn't actually describe it. It's after a Greek god, it's not related. We just thought it would be useful in a medical context. Now we use the word intersex to mean somebody with mixed sex characteristics in their body. So when you're thinking about that 1.7% of the population, you think like, well, that's kind of tiny, like, seems like a fairly negligible portion of the population, but that's about the same percentage of people in the world who have naturally red hair or who have green eyes. It's about the same percentage. So if you think about like the number of people that you see in the world, of course you can't tell somebody's hair's dyed, but usually people aren't changing their eye color too much. If you think about all the people in your life that you know that have green eyes, it's about the same number of people who are intersex. Not everybody who is intersex knows that they're intersex, which is part of the complex thing. For some people, it is something that they will go through their whole life never knowing, because it doesn't cause any problems for them physically. It might be, for instance, one way of being intersex is having a different chromosome pattern. So for instance, we usually think of XY for men and XX for women, but there are other different chromosome patterns like XXY that will create different bodies, people with different bodies. And unless there is like a medical reason why that would be harmful for somebody, there's no reason to change anything unless the person wants to. So it's fairly common for intersex folks to grow up and not know that they're intersex until they're going through puberty, because their puberty doesn't go as everybody expects it to go. So for instance, another way of being intersex is a condition where your body, you're assigned female, your body looks female to most people, but it's because you have this thing called androgen insensitivity, where your body can't process testosterone. So even though you have XY chromosomes and your body produces testosterone, it can't receive the testosterone. So your body never masculinizes and you look feminine. So there's lots of different ways to be intersex. And we bring that up as part of this conversation to kind of say, it's not as simple as you're a boy, you're a girl. There's a lot of genetic diversity and diversity of bodies in our world.
Awesome.
Yeah, go ahead.
So 1.7% of the population, that means like, that's like 6 million people in the United States.
Mm.
So that's a different way to think about, you're talking about millions of people.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other thing is, I've heard some podcasts and things about this whole chromosome thing.
Yeah.
You know, which is kind of interesting. And are you going to talk about that at all or not?
We're not going to talk too much about intersex folks. We will a little bit when we talk about scripture, but not a whole lot.
Okay,
I just wanted to make you aware of it, but there's lots of great resources about it. There should be a few on your resource list if you want to grab one of those on your way out.
Can I just follow on that? Because maybe you're going to say this too. But I don't know if you were thinking of the Radiolab series called on Gonads.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what you're talking about? The Gonad series?
Yep.
Because, so if you're going to talk about it, I won't. But,
one
point in relation to what you were saying and what you've just been saying, Austin, is they said that what we don't realize is that in everybody's cells, the male-female choice is not something that happened once, it's happening every moment.
Yeah.
That if you're male, the male trigger is winning, but the female trigger is always going, female, 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 and the male is saying, no, no, no. But it's a constant, lifelong thing. It's not like it's picked once and then resolved.
Yeah, that's the weird thing about our cells replicating all the time, is there's always possible mutations that could happen. But yeah, the Radiolab series, if you're an NPR person, Radiolab did a great series on, they called it, I think, Gonads, right?
Gonads, yeah.
And it's fascinating. So if you want to learn more, I'd recommend it. So, coming back to this big macro idea, right? We've talked about orientation, who you're attracted to, and we've talked a little bit about gender. This is the best way that I've found to explain sort of the LGBT community in general, because we can see it as a Venn diagram. There are some identities here that have more to do with orientation, others have more to do with gender, and some are kind of in the middle. So we're just going to talk about this for a second here. For these first three, lesbian, gay, and bisexual, they're all pretty standard. These are the folks that we have mostly been familiar with in the past, you know, for most of us, probably the last 50 years. There's been more media visibility for gay, lesbian, bisexual folks. Still, you know, in process, but it's something that we're a little bit more familiar with for most of us. Transgender folks are over on the gender side. So being trans does not have anything to do with who you're attracted to. It doesn't have anything to do with who you have sex with or anything like that. It's on the gender side specifically. The word queer is, of course, one that some people find really uncomfortable and don't like and don't want to use, which is legit, is fine. And for other people, it's a really freeing word. And it's one of the words that marginalized communities will reclaim as something that was once used against them, but now we use it for ourselves. And so that's a word that can sometimes refer to orientation and sometimes refer to gender. One of the best things about the word queer, for people who really like it, is that it has so many possible definitions that it requires you to get to know somebody in order to figure out what it means to them. So people like it sometimes because it's like, just because I tell you I'm queer doesn't mean you can put me in a box immediately. You have to actually get to know me first to find out what that means to me.
Now, interesting, when you say queer,
mm-hmm.
See, when I was young, way before you were born, that was a very derogatory term, right?
Yep.
It was just what you were saying. And now when you put it in the middle of the Venn diagram,
mm-hmm.
That assumes that it's this smaller part. But I have been led to believe, like people who've talked to me, saying that it includes both full circles.
Right.
So by putting it in the middle, you know, it looks like in that Venn diagram that queer is in the middle rather than the whole thing.
Sure. I get what you mean. I think that another way of creating a visual for this would be to do it as that sort of umbrella. Because you're right, queer is, it covers both things. So what would be maybe a better way to put this diagram would be to put queer as an umbrella term under orientation and gender. Because the reason I put it in the middle is not because lesbian folks don't identify as queer also, it's because queer covers both orientation and gender.
Yes.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Cool. I appreciate that feedback, though, because that's interesting. I'll have to think about that while I re-diagram this in the future. So intersex folks, which we just talked about, are over on the gender side as well. And then Two-Spirit folks. Two-Spirit is an identity that is specific to Native American or First Nations people. It was coined in the early 1990s. There was a meeting of LGBTQ plus Native folks up in, I believe it was in Montreal, and they said, you know, we all in our individual languages have words for how we identify in terms of orientation or gender, but wouldn't it be nice if, as Native folks as a whole, we had one word that we could all use, or one phrase we could all use? So they came up with Two-Spirit, and it came out of their particular traditions that saw people of different orientations and genders as being sort of like representative of multiple things in one. And so Two-Spirit kind of came about in the early 1990s to represent that. So folks who are not Native don't use that. It is specifically for Native communities. And then asexual is the last one on our list. And like I said, that one has to do with your maybe not having sexual attraction toward other people or experiencing it at a different rate or frequency, a lower rate or frequency. Go ahead, Ryan.
Where would you put our traditional concept of male and female?
So that we're going to, I believe, it's on the next slide. We're going to talk
on
about
this
that.
Diagram at all?
What was that?
Does it fit on this diagram at all?
So the this, as we're just looking at it, is just specifically like looking at the LGBT community. And so if we were going to talk about gender and orientation in terms of people who are not in the LGBT community, under orientation, we would put heterosexual or straight, right? Would be what people are who are not one of these other orientations. And on the gender side, we're going to talk about another word. The word is cisgender, C-I-S, gender. And we're going to talk about that in a second, but that would be on the gender side. So yeah, I'll talk about that, touch on that in just a minute here. So when we're talking about the word transgender, as you might have noticed, what was your name, sir? I didn't get your name.
Sean.
As Sean said, queer can be sometimes used as an umbrella term. Transgender is also an umbrella term. All of these things are kind of like, we think of them as like words for these larger communities that break down and break down and down and down. Kind of like you would think about like, well, Christian, right? Well, then you've got Protestant and Catholic, and then you break that down into Episcopalian and Lutheran and whatever. Like, that's kind of how this is working in terms of the taxonomy of this community. So, transgender is an umbrella term. It incorporates many different identities, but they all have to do with having a gender that is different from the sex you were assigned at birth. So that is the basic definition of transgender. It means that you were assigned one gender at birth, and then you realized that you were a different gender. That's the difference. So trans is the Latin prefix, and it just means across, like transatlantic, same thing. It was sort of a word that made sense to talk about moving across genders. That's kind of how we think about the word transgender. The word cisgender is the one I just mentioned, and that refers to people who have a gender and an assigned sex that match, that are the same. So that's the majority of the population. We have some idea that somewhere around 3% of the population is transgender. Which also, you're like, if only 3%, why have I been hearing about them so much? It's been a bit of a squeaky wheel situation where, and also, you know, it's just been a media talking point. But only about 3% of the population is trans. Most people are cisgender. That prefix there, C-I-S, means on the same side. So trans is moving across, cis is on the same side. So it's talking about your assigned sex and your gender identity. Go ahead.
Austin, I think maybe one thing that just occurred to me, and I don't know how accurate this is, but under transgender, we're talking about the gender you're assigned at birth.
Mm-hmm.
I think using the term assigned is maybe inaccurate and should be identified, maybe use identified at birth instead of assigned, because, you know, if the doctor looks at the child and the child has a penis, that child is identified as a male. It doesn't have any, it's not assigned being a male, but that doctor has identified the child as being a male, even though that child, when the child grows up, may have a totally different self-identification.
Right. I can see the wisdom in that. I think the pushback might be to say, I think the reason the word assigned has become the sort of lingua franca for this is because it's talking about this idea that the child has absolutely no agency in the moment. It's something that is put on them or given to them without their having any sense of agency in it. And I think that was what the strength of the word assigned gave, was kind of like speaking to the fact that it is something that somebody else decided for the infant. So I can see using identified, but I think that was why people moved toward using assigned, because it was saying like, this is something the kid can't tell you at that point, right? What their gender is or anything about their rest of their body. And so I think that was why that word was used. But I can see both.
And that's my point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because the child has no control over how the doctor decides that child is identified.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I can see both sides on that one. So as we're thinking about folks who are under this trans umbrella, there's a couple different identities, and so I'm going to throw a lot of words at you here. It's okay if you don't take them all in the first time. We'll use them throughout. So identities that fall under the trans umbrella. So we might talk about transgender men, who might be somebody who is assigned female at birth, but who knows themselves to be male. So that's me, for instance. I identify as a trans male. Trans women, of course, are people who are assigned male at birth, but who know themselves to be female. So trans men and trans women, if you're like, I can't remember if I'm supposed to talk about them, like, do I say trans men for people who are assigned male at birth or who identify as male? It's always what their gender identity is rather than what they were assigned, if that helps you remember which way to go with that. So trans men and trans women. But then there are non-binary folks. So binary, of course, meaning two options, you only get two, right? A non-binary person has a gender identity that doesn't conform to the male or female binary. They may feel like a combination of male and female, or they may identify as a completely different gender altogether. So when we're talking about non-binary folks, it's not as easy as saying, you know, there's men and there's women, and then there's the third option, non-binary. Non-binary just means not the binary, but non-binary itself is another layer of umbrella. So when we think about non-binary folks, all that non-binary means is you don't identify as just male or just female. So there's a couple different ways that shows up. You may be agender. So agender, like asexual, right? Asexual meant you didn't have sexual attraction to other people. Agender means you don't have an experience of gender. It just doesn't exist for you. So agender folks may sort of fall under that non-binary identity umbrella because they don't identify as just male or just female. Gender fluid folks may experience their gender as something that changes over time. So if you're gender fluid, it may be that your gender changes over time, and it might be like a year-to-year type of thing, or it might be a day-to-day type thing. It's really not, I want to stress that this is not like multiple personalities or anything like that. It's just that your experience of your gender and how you interact with people, how you express your gender, may change. And it honestly changes for all of us throughout our lives. It's just for these folks, it may be more frequent than for other people. And so genderqueer, much like the word queer itself, is one that is intentionally a little bit vague, right? But there are two sort of ways that I have seen genderqueer show up as a label in folks that I work with. For some people, they use the word genderqueer because they don't feel like they fit in the binary. They are kind of under the non-binary umbrella. And they use the term to allow for ambiguity. Genderqueer, much like the word queer itself, if you want to know what it means, you have to actually have a relationship with the person, and that's the strength of that. Why would somebody use genderqueer rather than just queer? It might be that they're trying to tell you something specific about their gender, and they want to make sure you know it's not about their orientation. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Cool. The other reason that somebody might use the word genderqueer is because they see their gender identity as an intentional disruption of the gender binary. That they kind of think, I'm frustrated with the way that men and women are like systems of patriarchy and things that, like, you know, we are all frustrated with to some extent. But they, for folks who identify as genderqueer, might say, I want to, or I recognize that my gender itself should intentionally disrupt the harmful systems that we have in place.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a little bit of a like politicalization of an identity, but it's intentional. So not everybody who's genderqueer feels that way or identifies that way, but it is one of the ways that genderqueer folks may show up. So, as I said before, if somebody you know identifies this way and you have a relationship with them, don't go up to somebody on the street and ask them about it, but like, if it's somebody you have a relationship with, you can ask them what they, how they define these terms for themselves. One more term here I'm going to throw at you, which is gender expansive. I use the phrase gender expansive a lot. Gender expansive or gender nonconforming just describes people who express their gender in non-normative ways for their society. And it doesn't necessarily mean somebody's trans. So for instance, you could say that a woman who shaves her head and rides a motorcycle is gender expansive because she's not conforming to our idea of femininity. So you could say she's gender expansive even if she was assigned female at birth and identifies as female. The way she's expressing her gender is gender expansive. So that's a word that we use as kind of a catch-all term for folks who maybe color a little bit outside the lines, but maybe don't identify as trans. Go ahead.
It seems like you're adding another category here, Austin. I just wanted to get some clarity here. So the what you just referred to, and you were doing that a little on the genderqueer thing, is the social construction of behaviors that are associated with particular genders.
Right.
But that strikes me as a whole different category, isn't it, than transness or orientation? Like just for instance, so I've got a ponytail,
mm-hmm.
okay, and I like to cook
mm-hmm.
and things, but I don't associate with anything other than, thanks to feminism 60 years ago, I can do whatever I want to do and so can women. Like,
right.
It didn't affect my identity, my gender identity,
mm-hmm.
any, it just affected how I feel about what tasks feel comfortable to me, or
sure.
what clothing or what appearance feels comfortably.
Right. And I think that the big thing that it all turns on in that moment is recognizing what labels people claim for themselves. That, like, if you could have a ponytail and love cooking and say, I'm not gender expansive, I'm just a man who's maybe a feminist, like, you know, like, that's how you express yourself and identify. But you could just as easily be a person with a ponytail who likes cooking and was assigned male at birth and does identify as gender expansive, but it's your specific, ability to, lived experience and ability to express that for yourself.
I appreciate it. You're always bringing it back to the person's self-identity. But as a category label, it seems like it's labeling a different set of things.
Sure,
right?
It has to do with gender.
It's how you interact with not just the gender you've been assigned, but the social role you've been assigned
right.
that comes with that gender.
Yep, and that's why we kind of, there are parts of gender roles that we sort of roll into that third section of gender expression, that like gender roles and gender expression go together in some ways. And it's complex, of course, because, you know, there are some people for whom their identity is their identity, and they don't care about how it's politicized or what they do with it or what it says about the roles in the world. They're just themselves. And there are other people who say, well, I'm genderqueer, and it is a political statement, and I'm going to make it a political statement, and it's about bringing, like, these categories that are harmful, bringing more clarity to those categories. So, yeah, I get what you're saying, though, that it's like, if it's about gender roles, then in some way, everybody's a little bit gender expansive.
Right.
So I get what you're saying about having that different category. I think it's helpful to bring it back to like personal identification and to bring it back to the idea that gender roles and gender expressions are just one part of this larger picture. Does that help a little?
Yep.
Okay.
I think so.
So just a note here, another note. Intersex identities and trans identities are different. Like I said before, we kind of talked a little bit about intersex folks. But there is some crossover between these two communities. So, for instance, some intersex people, if you are an intersex person who is assigned, like for instance in that example of the person who has androgen insensitivity, they may have been assigned female at birth. They may have lived their, up to puberty, not realizing that they had, XY chromosomes and just couldn't process those androgens. But maybe they internally felt male their whole life up to that point. And so at that point, maybe they realize that they're intersex. They realize that if they want to, they can go on hormone therapy to help them with the insensitivity that they have. And then they may experience a transition of identities, having lived prior to puberty as female and living as male after puberty. So even though intersex people and trans people are different, there is some overlap in experiences between our two communities. Does that make sense? Cool. Yeah, go ahead.
So I'm not sure if you're going to cover this, but I learned about the chromosome thing recently, and that opened up a can of worms when I looked into it more online, where, as far as I'm understanding it, a lot of, there's like a bad history with people then taking that idea and saying, oh, well, should, like, or are all trans people then intersex? Is that like an explanation for why someone could be trans? Mm-hmm. And that's harmful as far as I'm aware, right?
Yeah.
Because not every trans person is going to be intersex.
Right, so we're going to talk, I've got a slide, a few slides later in here that talks about like why are people intersex, and there are a lot of theories about biological reasons for that, in the same way that, 20 years ago, 15 years ago, we were really intent on finding the gay gene. People are doing the same thing now with trans folks, where they're like, there's got to be a biological reason for this. So some people have said, well, being trans is just an intersex variation of the brain. So that's been an argument. I also have heard from colleagues that I work with who are intersex, that that is harmful to intersex communities, because basically one of the major things that the intersex community is running into is that there has been for a long time this really common practice of doing surgery on infants who are born intersex. If there is a visible difference, they will do surgery sometimes without even the knowledge of the parents to make these babies look more normal. And it's, without the child's consent, they're going to live their whole body or their whole life in that body. And so intersex folks have different sort of struggles that they're up against. And if trans folks just sort of co-opt that and say like, well, this is our struggle too, but like we don't actually talk about what intersex people are experiencing, it can be very harmful. Yeah. I appreciate you bringing that up.
I
go ahead.
I'm going back just for a minute to the gender expansive. People who describe or express their gender in non-normative ways. What I flashed on is when I see in San Francisco a parade, and I see some people that are obviously male, and they're dressed like women or far out. I guess that's where they would come into that category.
Not necessarily.
And
I mean,
for some reason, I have trouble with that. It's I don't know why it's offensive to me, but I think it somehow, in my mind, creates a negative view of a person that is gay. I really don't have a problem with it, but I think for the way they express themselves is so outrageous sometimes. That it puts a negative slant on it, maybe, for people that are on the edge.
I think.
Would they fit in that category then?
You'd have to ask them. Is that honest answer to that?
Is that an example, or could that be an example of gender?
It might be. Yeah. I mean, so here's the way that I would say it: is I tend to use gender expansive as a catch-all term for people who are clearly expressing their gender differently than you would expect based on our norms, our cultural norms, but I have no idea if they identify as trans or gay or anything else. And so if I don't know somebody, I may refer to them in that way so as to, as sort of a it is a little bit of a, I don't want to label them as a label they don't actually use. So gender expansive acts a little bit as a catch-all until you know what that person actually identifies as. So that's the way that it tends to show up. But of course, if you got to know somebody and they were like, do not use the word gender expansive or the phrase gender expansive for me because I'm actually this, then there's your answer, right? Because you have to actually get to know somebody in order to know that. But I want to speak to what you said about like that feeling of like feeling like there's a block put in between you in that moment because of the way that they're presenting. Because I think that's a really common thing for folks when we don't know how to engage with somebody who so clearly doesn't care that it makes us uncomfortable. and I think that's it's something that in that moment I think we can learn something more about ourselves than we learn about them in that moment. Like just noticing like, wow, I feel really uncomfortable seeing that person dressing in that way. Right, yeah, and so you kind of have to do a little bit of unpacking internally, and we all have that. I have that about, like, there is, you know, in if you're familiar with any sort of work with marginalized communities, mm-hmm. there's this thing called respectability politics, which is essentially like, if you're in a small community that is already demonized, you want to make sure everybody in your community stays in line, or they'll make you look bad. And so there are times when I notice that in myself, where I see people that are doing gender in a way I would never express my gender, and I think, gosh, I wish they would just get it together. But like that tells me something about me, not something about them. Yeah. I appreciate you sharing that. Thank you for sharing that. Did you have something, Julia?
Oh, I was just going to say, too, that I don't know exactly what you saw, but I'm wondering just about, like, drag and mm-hmm. the imagination and the play of gender to really expand and interrogate gender mm-hmm. norms. And drag is a way of, in some ways, letting people play with gender and kind of push beyond these binaries that we have been socialized for a long time, because actually there have been like many ancient expressions and understandings of gender as not being just male and female.
Right. Yeah, and I appreciate you bringing drag into it, because sometimes people will say like, well, you've made this distinction between orientation and gender, but like drag, the experience of like dressing as a different gender as a form of entertainment is usually done, it's like a thing that we see done most by gay men. Mm-hmm. So like, how can that, like, where does that fit in here? Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh, I just got surprised by the deer outside. Deer's come to listen. So yeah, where does that fit in, right? And the idea there is that even though who you're attracted to and your own identity are separate things, I'll speak just for our sort of white Western culture in general, has seen those two things enmeshed so much that when we see, for instance, a person that we identify, that we see like as male, and they are moving their body in a more feminine way, our first thought is not that they're trans or gender expansive. Our first thought is, oh, that's a gay guy, because he's acting more feminine. See how like we've sort of combined those two things? So with drag, the idea there is that what you're doing is gender expression as a means of performance. Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily saying anything about how you identify, how your gender, how you experience your gender. It might be, there are trans people who do drag, but it's a form of performance for performance sake, mm-hmm. not to express your own gender. So that's kind of, and it's done mostly by gay men because historically, gay men, and I think, this is my own personal view on it, historically gay men have been expected to be feminine, and at some point you kind of just say, well, if that's what you already think about me, I'm just gonna go for it. That's just my own personal theory on it. Not as somebody who, I just have friends who do drag, but I don't, so I can't say for sure. But yeah, so gender as performance rather than as a show of your internal experience are two different things. Does that make sense? Cool. So when we're thinking about trans people today, what do trans people look like? I think we have maybe expectations about what trans people look like. These are just a couple of folks of some, a couple of pictures of some famous trans folks, folks who have talked a lot about their gender and their experience. And it's something where just like, you know, any other group of people, we have expectations about what they might look like. And so sometimes I think it's helpful to be like, look, there's a huge variety. People express their gender identity in lots of different ways. And these are all people who identify somewhere under the trans umbrella. So yeah, I just think that's helpful sometimes to think about, like, who are these people? Much like we talked about with orientation, that you can't tell just by looking at someone, you also can't assume just by looking at somebody that somebody is trans either. There may be things that you think, well, that's, you know, that's a giveaway in some way, but that is based on our own assumptions, which might be wrong, right? When you assume, you know the rest of the sentence. one of the ways that it's helpful to just see trans people in the world and to know that, like, they're around, and it's not like they're going to stick out like a sore thumb every time. You probably have been around trans people your whole life and haven't known it. So let's talk about some basics about how we talk about this community. So first of all, transgender is an adjective. It's a descriptive word. So you would say somebody is a transgender person, not a transgender. That last one's using it like a noun, right? So it's a descriptive word for a person. You also don't need to add the ED on the end of it. That's something that has been sort of a recent thing that people have been a little bit more insistent about. If you read books even from 10 years ago, you might see it with the ED on the end. It's a way to date things now to see which way they spell it. So we don't usually use the ED on the end because it doesn't make sense as an adjective that way. It also makes it sound like something terrible has happened to you. You got hit by a bus and you got transgendered. So the ED is unnecessary. So a couple terms to be careful with. The word transsexual is still used by some trans people today, but not very many. It's been largely replaced by transgender. So I would default to transgender, unless I have a friend who's like, no, use this word for me. The reason for that is that transsexual has historically been used to describe people who are trans who have gone through medical transition. And so it became sort of an insider-outsider word. Like, we're going to talk about transition here in a minute, but like, say that you're a trans person, but you haven't had any medical transition, you are sort of considered less than. You're not transsexual, so you're less than. So because we noticed that there was this power dynamic going on in our community, we've kind of moved more towards using transgender. But again, not by all people. Some people fought for 40 years of their life to claim the word transsexual, and by gosh darn it, they're going to use it. and that's totally legitimate, but just to be aware of that. The other thing is, you probably, if you're familiar with trans people in media, you've probably heard sex change as the sort of word that's used. Nowadays, we use the word transition. It's a little bit more accurate because the idea of, like, one surgery that changes your sex is not accurate for anybody. There's lots of different ways to medically transition. So transitioning as a process is the way we talk about it today. I believe that's everything for that slide. So let's talk about transition and what that actually is. Many trans people, not all, but many, experience this thing called gender dysphoria. Gender dysphoria is a distress or dissonance caused by the difference between your gender and your assigned sex. Many trans people choose to transition in order to lessen dysphoria and move toward the opposite, euphoria. More Greek words to throw at you. So gender dysphoria is that, I always think about it as like the internal feeling of nails on a chalkboard. it feels different for everybody. My experience of gender dysphoria felt a little bit like I was carrying around one of those giant cardboard cutouts of who everybody thought I was, and I was just sort of carrying it around in front of me all the time, and people were always talking to the cardboard cutout, and I was just standing behind it like, hello. the feeling of not being seen, not actually being talked to, and being seen as something that you're not, the fear of being, there's almost a fear of being found out, which is weird, because like nobody would ever just like assume or think that you were trans, but there's this feeling of like, if only they really knew the real me, in both like a hopeful way and in a scary way, because it's a scary thing sometimes. But so gender dysphoria is going to feel different for different people, but gender dysphoria is usually the motivating factor for people to transition. So there's a couple different ways to transition. Their social transition, which includes things like changing your name or your pronouns, changes in clothing or hairstyle or other gender expressive things. There's medical transition, which might include hormone replacement therapy or HRT, or gender affirmation surgery or voice therapy, anything that has to do with like changing your body in a, yeah, changing your body, I think would be a good shorthand for the medical part of it. And then legal transition, which includes things like changing your markers on your documents and licenses, passports, etc. Other than social transition, the other two parts of this are time-consuming and expensive and difficult and has a lot of hoops. I think it's helpful to know that like trans people who transition, it's not an easy thing or a thing that people would just do on a whim. It's a process and it's a difficult process. Even if it's joyful, it's still a difficult one. So it's also important to note that not all trans people transition. There might be some people who know themselves to be trans and never want to do anything about that, who never want to transition. For a variety of reasons. There may be people who say, you know what, I just want to change my name and my pronouns, and that's good enough for me, and that alleviates my dysphoria, I'm good. And there are some people for whom all of these make sense, because they get to actually be the person who they are, to feel like they can put that cardboard cutout down and just be themselves. So that's part of what transition looks like. Now here's the complex thing about transition. Being transgender is not a mental illness. However, because of the way healthcare works, in order to do anything medically, you require a diagnosis. And so the way that our medical system has decided to fix this is by saying, well, you're not mentally ill, but we have to have a diagnosis. So in the DSM-5, the Diagnostic Statistic Manual for Mental Health Professionals, gender dysphoria is a diagnosable condition. They're not diagnosing you with an identity, they're diagnosing you with this thing that's really difficult to deal with. And so the idea with transition is that it's helping to alleviate that gender dysphoria. So it's complicated because some people will be like, well, if you're not mentally ill, why are you in the mental illness manual? And it's because of the way our medical system works. If we had another way that didn't require a medical diagnosis, we do it that way. But because health insurance companies and doctors and things require diagnoses so they don't get malpractice lawsuits, that's the way it works. Anybody have any questions about this slide?
Are you going to talk about pronoun changes later?
Yes.
Okay.
All right. We're going to talk most about pronouns on Friday, just so you know. So, trans youth. Here's the thing about trans youth. I want to talk about this because there are so many media scare stories about like little kids having surgery, and it's not a thing. It doesn't happen. Transition has enough medical hoops, there's no way they would allow a four-year-old to go through them. So let's talk about trans youth here. From what we know from developmental psychology and from documented experience, trans people tend to come to understand their gender at one of these three points in life. Ages 2 to 3, because that's when you're first realizing you're a person and you're like separate from your parents. Ages 10 to 14, because that's when puberty kicks in, and if you're suddenly going through the wrong puberty, that's very distressing. And ages 18 to 22, and that's because in a lot of the Western world, that's the moment when you get out from under your parents' roof and you can explore your own identity a little bit more without fearing for instance, your housing situation. Not true for everybody, but for some. So these three points are the most likely time for people to figure it out, but you may know at 3 and not come out till you're 60. So it's not like if you don't come out in one of these three spots, you're not really trans. It's just that these are the developmentally most likely times for you to figure it out. So kids love to play with gender, and we want to encourage them to not conform to, you know, we don't want our kids to be like, only boys can play with trucks and only girls can play with dolls, right? We've kind of realized that that's not a healthy thing to enforce on our kids. So how do we figure out when our kid is just being playful with gender in a way that is totally like expected and good, and when our kid might actually be trans and is trying to like tell us something about who they are? Psychologists that work with trans youth talk about this trinity here of kids that are consistent, persistent, and insistent about their gender. Those are the things that child mental health workers look for. If the kid is having absolute breakdowns every time they have to wear a certain kind of clothing that is like gendered, that's maybe something to think about. Maybe just like that's information to file away. If this kid has insisted to you for a year now that mom, I'm actually a boy, mom, I'm actually a girl, that's something to know. This is all information to take in, and it's kind of like, if you have multiple pieces of this information, it's a good thing to see if you can find somebody in your area who is competent in trans care to talk with them, because it may be that you go and you talk with them and your kid is like, I don't know, I just feel like this right now, and who knows, you know? Or it may be that they are consistent, insistent, persistent, that like maybe it's a real thing to talk about as a family. So those are the three things that folks look for over time. And there are a lot of really good biographies written by parents of trans kids quite recently. So there's no end of things I can recommend to you if you'd love to read any of those. So here's the thing. There is no form of medical transition for children before puberty, period. The only thing that would happen before puberty is a social transition, so changing of clothes, name, pronouns. That's it. Nothing has changed in somebody's body prior to puberty. Once you reach puberty, then there are medications called puberty blockers. And puberty blockers are really awesome. We've actually used them for many, many years for other things. It's only been recently that we've been using them for trans kids. But basically, what puberty blockers do is hit pause on your body's ability to produce and take in hormones, sex hormones specifically. So it's a presses pause on puberty, and when you stop taking these hormone blockers, your natal puberty starts back up again. So it's great because they are almost entirely reversible. Now, what do I mean when I say almost entirely? The only way they wouldn't be reversible is if you have a kid, for instance, who starts hormone blockers at, say, age 10, because they've been talking, their family has been in therapy talking, getting support about this, they go on hormone blockers at 10, and then they get to age 14, they're still on these hormone blockers, and the doctor says, okay, this kid has been consistent, insistent, persistent about their gender for these many years now, and in order to keep them on track with their peers, we might want to start them on hormone therapy now, which is what's sometimes called cross-sex hormone therapy. So testosterone for trans boys, and progesterone and estrogen for trans girls. In that case, if you go directly from hormone blockers to cross-sex hormones, the long-term effect is that your reproductive organs won't mature, so you might not be able to have children. So that's the thing that parents are always concerned about, is like that's the one thing. But if your kid is on hormone blockers until 10, and then they go off hormone blockers, everything is reversed. They go right back to whatever puberty they were in to start with. So that's why I say almost totally reversible, because like the puberty blockers themselves are reversible, but if you then add on the cross-sex hormones on top of it, then you have some concerns about fertility over time. HRT, hormone replacement therapy, you could start between ages 14 to 16 with parents' consent, and most states require both parents' consent. So if even one parent is like, I don't know about this, game over. No surgery is allowed on trans youth under 16 in any state, and most states require a person to be at least 18. Any questions on trans youth?
So we're talking about a fair amount of trauma for those youth. They haven't reached 18, and they've got to deal with who they are and who people think they are.
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought that up, because what we're talking about is people are so concerned about what might be reversible or irreversible about things like puberty blockers or hormone therapy that they forget that natal puberty is irreversible. If we just let the kids go through puberty knowing that they're trans, there are things about that that will affect them forever. For trans women, for instance, trans feminine folks, once your voice drops, and there's nothing you can do about that for the rest of your life. You can do voice training to help a little bit, but there's nothing medically that can be done about that. For transmasculine folks, once your chest comes in, there's nothing you can do about that except surgery. But if you were able to be on hormone blockers so that you never had to develop the wrong way in the first place, that reduces a lot of stress and trauma. So yeah, it can be really, really difficult for kids who are just not allowed to do any sort of transition until they're 18, because that in itself is irreversible. Yeah. So, what time is it here? Some ideas on why are people trans? And this goes back to your sort of question on like this idea of, is there some sort of biological reason? Is there any connection with intersex folks in intersex communities? There are a lot of theories about why people are trans, and none of them are proven. So I'm giving you some, like, here are some possible things, but we don't have enough data on any of this to know whether it's true or not. So here's what we know. It could be genetics. We know that there are variations in genetic receptors in trans men that will often refuse to accept progesterone, and in trans women that will often refuse to accept testosterone. And that's like a natal genetic thing that they just have. Some trans people just have this. And so since some trans people have this genetic difference, there's been a question of like, well, is there something in genetics that makes you trans? We don't know. Is it hormone exposure when you're in the uterus? That might be it. We've seen cases with trans men who they have this high prenatal androgen exposure. And that people with that high prenatal androgen exposure are more likely to be attracted to people of the same gender and or to have gender dysphoria. So we know there's something going on with hormones in the uterus, but we don't really know what exactly. We just know there's something happening there. It could be brain structure. So when I said that bit about our body section of the thing, of the trilogy there that includes brain matter, this is what I was talking about. That there have been brain scans done that show that trans women in the, this is great, the bed nucleus of the stria terminalis, they have a brain that is more similar to cisgender women than to cisgender men. So people who know themselves to be female have brains that look like cisgender women, not like cisgender men. Same thing for trans men and for trans women in the anterior hypothalamus. It is closer to the gender you know yourself to be than it is to your assigned sex. Your brain is different. So maybe it's an evolutionary benefit, possibly. There's this thing called the kin selection hypothesis, and it's been used to explain gay and lesbian folks, and so they just sort of grandfathered trans folks into it, into this idea. Basically, the idea is it benefits a community to have more adults who don't have their own biological kids, because then you have more caretakers. So if you have people who don't have their own biological kids, either because they're in a same gender relationship or because they are trans and maybe the fertility is different in terms of who their partner is, you're gonna have more adults than you have children, and that is beneficial for children to have more caregivers. So there's like all of these theories out there about why people are trans, either sort of biologically, socially, whatever, evolutionarily. But we just don't have enough data on any of it to say if any of it is like a solid reason. So going back to what we said earlier about like, is this just being intersex but it's in your brain? Like I said, it's a way to describe this, but because we don't have enough scientific backing, it's not a great way to describe it, and it can end up co-opting the struggles of intersex individuals, which are different than the struggles trans people have. The important thing to remember is that no matter why people are trans, changing their gender identity doesn't work. You might think, as we're thinking about like transition, wouldn't it just be easier to change your brain to match your body than to change your body to match your brain? Wouldn't that just be easier? Unfortunately, it's not. Or fortunately, I don't know. But it's not possible. The APA, along with every other reputable psychological association, shows that changing somebody's gender identity to match their assigned sex doesn't work. They've tried it, all it does is cause trauma. So WPATH, which is like the main organization for medical accountability for trans folks, they point out that treatment aimed at trying to change a person's gender identity and expression to become more congruent with sex assigned at birth has been attempted in the past without success, particularly in the long term. Such treatment is no longer considered ethical. Why is it not ethical? Because we have all kinds of studies done. This was the largest one, 27,000 transgender people. and shows that trans people who have been exposed to conversion therapy efforts were twice as likely to attempt suicide, and those exposed to the efforts before age 10 were 4 times as likely to attempt suicide. So we know that attempts to change somebody's gender identity doesn't work, and when we try it, it causes terrible things, terrible outcomes. So even though we don't know why people are trans, we know what doesn't work, and we know what does work. There's a lot of really interesting data on the mental health of trans people going way up post-transition and like even in the midst of transition. So I'm going to talk a little bit more about that on Friday. So I'm going to go to the last section here, which is gender diversity in human history. We think about trans people as something new. And it's not. We've seen gender expansive people, to use that as a catch-all term, throughout history. We've also seen an acknowledgement of intersex people throughout history. Now, the reason that I'm kind of combining or putting together examples of intersex people in history and examples of gender expansive people in history is because oftentimes we don't know which is which. We don't have enough documentation. So they may be somebody who had a difference in sex development, or they may be somebody who was just assigned something at birth and had a gender identity that was different. And if we don't have enough documented evidence to know, we kind of end up lumping them together. So I want to give you a couple examples here. In terms of the ancient world, we have one of the Sumerian creation stories, the main one, talks about the goddess Ninmah forming the original humans with mixed external reproductive organs. The idea of intentionally creating trans people, or intentionally creating intersex people, I'm sorry. And many ancient religious traditions include deities with mixed sex characteristics, including in Hindu, Greek, Aztec, and Egyptian cultures. The idea that people who experienced their gender differently, whether because they were intersex or because they were trans, they would have special relationships with these ancient gods who exhibited these gender-expansive traits. The idea was like you would have a special relationship with people that sort of share that part of your identity. But of course, the most obvious connection for a lot of us in sort of the Western canon is Plato's Symposium. And if you're not familiar, that's the story of how soulmates are made because the gods originally created humans as sort of like this, back-to-back people, and then threw down lightning bolts, split them in two, and that's how you find your soulmates. You're supposed to find the other person who is the other half of you. So that's sort of the origin of the Western idea of a soulmate. And so this idea of the original people being created in this way is something that shows up in a lot of places, and we're actually going to talk about how it shows up in our own creation stories tomorrow. But this idea of people being created with ambiguous genitalia or mixed sex development characteristics is something that shows up in the ancient world all the time. When we're looking at modern history, we have a lot of really interesting folks to look at, but these are just two. Elbert Cashier, he's here on the left. He was a Union Civil War soldier. He was assigned female at birth, but lived as male for the last 53 years of his life. He dressed as male, joined the military for the Union, and fought, and it was only found out that he was assigned female after his death, which is a fairly common story for a lot of folks who are assigned male but then live their lives, or assigned female but live their lives as men. It's a pretty common theme throughout history. One thing I will say about that theme of people assigned female who live their lives as men is, kind of coming back to what you were saying about gender roles, that there's constantly a discussion of, did this person live their life as male because it was a freer way to live your life, or is it because they really identified as male? Sometimes we have the answer to that, sometimes we don't. But it's a common theme throughout history. The person on the right here is Huehua, who was a person from the Zuni people of New Mexico, was the first out gender expansive or gender diverse person to meet a US president. She identified as Ilhamana, so this is sort of like one of the the most known person who would today be considered two-spirit in sort of the wider sense of that word. 1886, we had a sitting president meet with somebody who was outside of the bounds of gender as we understood it, which is something that we don't often think about. Like, this was just a thing that happened. But it is important to note that the ways that white supremacy and colonialism tends to erase gender diversity, because especially we see this in Central and South America, where conquistadors would show up and say, hold on, first of all, this doesn't match our culture, and second of all, it doesn't jive with Catholicism, so like we have to figure out what to do with this. Vasco Núñez de Balboa is like probably the most infamous example of this. He lands in what is today Panama, sees people who were assigned male at birth presenting as female, and immediately labels them sodomites. So again, you see that connection between gender and sexuality or orientation. All Balboa knew in his experience was, well, there are people who are, you know, what we would say today, he was thinking there are gay people and there are straight people, and Catholicism doesn't allow gay people, so I have to kill these folks. Not knowing that his lens was completely irrelevant to what the actual Cueva people were experiencing and how they lived. So that's another common theme throughout history. A couple of examples of gender diversity within Christian history. This is my favorite saint. This is Saint Marius or Marinos the Monk from the 5th century. This illustration here is actually from the 14th century, so much longer after that. But the story of Marius or Marinos is a fascinating one. Basically, when Marius was a child, Marius was assigned female at birth, but Marius, his father wanted to enter a monastery, and Marius, as somewhere like puberty-ish age, pre-puberty, said, I want to come with you. I also want to join the monastery. There's this great story where he says to his father, you would save your own soul and leave mine. Let me join as well. And they end up joining this monastery together with Marius dressed as a boy. And Marius grows up in this monastery. And as an adult, after his father dies, his father was the only one who knew that he was assigned female at birth. After his father dies, Marius is accused, after a trip out to the local community, Marius is accused of having sex with the local innkeeper's daughter and of getting her pregnant. And Marius himself would not have been able to do that, as far as we know, being assigned female at birth. And so the abbot of the monastery says, you have to leave. You've had relations out of wedlock, you fathered this child, you can't be here anymore, and Marius gets kicked out of the monastery. Marius goes and takes care of this child for the rest of his life. Mm. 2 years after, I believe it was 2 years, after getting kicked out, he brings the child back to the monastery and says, I came with my father, now let this child come with me. And they both enter the monastery together. Mm. And Marius cares for this child for the rest of his life. That was not his biologically, but rather than telling them about how he was assigned at birth, he decided to make that choice. And it was only after his death that they figured out he was actually assigned female. So Marius is one of my favorites. That's what I just said. another favorite is Madre Juana de la Cruz, who lived in the 15th century, so moving up in time a little bit. Madre Juana was, she's currently venerable, she's moving her way up to saint. She was born in Spain and insisted her whole life that the Virgin Mary had intervened to change her from a boy to a girl in the womb because of her mother's prayers. And she pointed to her large Adam's apple as proof of the fact that she was going to be a boy and then got changed. So now when we read Madre Juana's story, we often think she was probably intersex, we don't know for sure. But that would be what people would guess now. But she dressed in both masculine and feminine clothes throughout her life, and she is known as being, she's one of the lesser known religious leaders who wrote about God, the feminine part of God, and God as female. Mm-hmm. So if you enjoy any of the other great Christian writers, and you can read Spanish, some of it has been translated, but if you can read Spanish especially, her writing is really, really beautiful, very poetic. And then, of course, probably the one everybody knows the best is Joan of Arc, and everybody argues about whether Joan was female and taking on a masculine role, or if maybe she identified as male. Again, we don't know. But Jonah is one of those characters that everybody kind of loves to claim because she has such an interesting story. So you kind of know the story of Joan of Arc, I'm sure, already. But this idea of Joan going to fight to free France from the English, and then she's captured and she's tried first for heresy, but what she's actually killed for is cross-dressing. So the thing that she's actually killed for is not, like, they were using that as an excuse. They wanted to kill her regardless. But that was actually the thing that she was executed for, was dressing in the wrong clothes. And there's the larger part of the story is, was she ever even given any other clothes? Were those the only clothes, once she was captured, was she even given the option to wear any other clothes? Was she set up? It's a whole nother story. But she's a big character that is a interesting character in Christian history when we think about gender expansive identities. So that's where I'm going to end for today. Hopefully I'll see you again tomorrow and the next couple days. Thanks so much.
Thank you.